Hello, I'm Krupa Bharti. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday, the 7th of March. Six Bulgarians living in the UK have been convicted of masterminding a Europe-wide spying operation for Russia. We ask what Russia is hoping to achieve by targeting the UK. Also, after a day of confusing words from Donald Trump over Ukraine and Russia, we ask what's driving his foreign policy agenda and why toothbrushing could be taught in schools as part of a government scheme. We hear from one that's running toothbrushing classes. It's being called one of the largest foreign intelligence operations in the UK, showing the changing nature of threats facing the nation. Three Bulgarian nationals living in London have been found guilty of spying for Russia. Vanya Gaberova, Katrin Inanova and Tirmir Ivanchev, all in their 30s, were part of a group who carried out surveillance on people and places between 2020 and 2023. They were working for fellow Bulgarian Orlin Rusev, who ran the spy ring from a former guest house in Great Yarmouth in Norfolk.
Police! Police, stay where you are! Police! Police, stay where you are! Police, police! Stay there!
It's the wrong place.
Support!
I think it's the wrong place.
Now, when police raided the guest house in 2023, they found it was full of tools used for spying.
Are all of these devices yours?
I have purchased some on the eBay and I'm repairing many of those.
They're yours, aren't they?
And it was whilst they were working as a beautician, a healthcare worker and a decorator that they were secretly monitoring a US military base in Germany and investigative journalists. Journalists such as Roman Dobrokhotov, editor of The Insider, who's been speaking to the BBC's Daniel Desimoni.
I'm very lucky to be alive, actually. I think assassination was one of the options that they reviewed. But even if it was kidnapping, that doesn't mean that I was just, you know, brought to Russia and then let free. It was about interrogating and then killing.
Who ordered that you should be targeted?
I think that it was Vladimir Putin directly. In this dictatorship, you would never take responsibility on your own to do such a political stuff. You will always have direct order from the president. It doesn't have to be a written order.
Andrei Soldatov is a Russian investigative journalist and an expert on Russian espionage. He told me more about how the three were recruited.
It is the most interesting part of the story because we got used from all these stories of the Cold War that when you are dealing with spies, we are dealing with people who are highly motivated, really well trained, a part of a group, and they should have someone right from Moscow to run them and control them. It is not the case with these people. They are not trained agents. They were not recruited or trained by a Russian intelligence officer. So that makes it this story very different from what we had before.
And I understand that you know some of the people targeted by these spies.
Yes, I do.
Do you know if you've been targeted at all?
Well, I have police protection. As far as I know about this particular case and this particular group of people, I was not, thanks God, a target. But of course, it sends a very strong message to many Russian journalists in exile that they could be a target for such operations.
And Andrei, would you say that Russia's espionage operations have changed significantly since the invasion of Ukraine in 2022?
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, we see that they are getting much more aggressive and much more adventurous. It was prompted to some extent by massive expulsions in 2022, and many people with diplomatic cover left European countries, including the UK. The problem is that the Russian intelligence agencies found a way how to, so to say, regroup. And they found a new sense of purpose. And now they are using people. Some of these people have no Russian connections. They are not Russian nationals. They do not have diplomatic cover. And they don't much care of being exposed and expelled or even arrested. Because as we all know, Vladimir Putin cares very much about his people being arrested in the West. And he made a special effort to get them back if he could. And he gets his people back.
It's interesting. I mean, we're talking about the UK here. But what do we know about the extent of this spy cell and just how vast it actually is?
Of course, unfortunately, we know that in Europe it's much bigger. We already see very, well, dangerous attacks in Germany. Obviously, there are some other countries where it's better to be very, very cautious and it's better not to make public your travels to these countries. And the problem is that we do not see, or at least they believe, that the West doesn't have a proper response to this increase in aggressiveness, mostly because during the Cold War, Russian intelligence agencies never used the option of sabotage. And that's why there is no ready answer what to do about it.
And what does this sabotage look like?
The thing is that sabotage operations carried out right now by Russian intelligence agencies, they look not extremely sophisticated and not really competent, but that is not what their objective is. It's not only about destroying properties or attacking individuals. It's also about sending a message that from now on, you need to care and spend more resources on protection of the industries or people. And that is objective, to raise the costs, to raise the cost of protection, to raise the cost for providing military support to Ukraine, to raise the cost of for providing security and protection to Russian exiles. And it works even if the operations are not really successful.
Insight there from the Russian investigative journalist Andrei Soldatov. Coming up on The World Tonight, after a day of confusing words today from Donald Trump on the war in Ukraine, we try to unpick where his leadership has left America's place in the world.
The U.S.-Europe alliance has been the anchor of stability in the world. And the fact that this anchor is now being shattered, I don't think it's good for the cause of Western democracies to be divided this way.
Do stay with us for that. Now, neuroscientists working with survivors from Israel's Nova Festival after the 7th of October Hamas attacks say that there are early signs that MDMA, or ecstasy, may provide some psychological protection from trauma. Preliminary findings from a large-scale study being carried out at Israel's Haifa University suggest that the illegal drug, which induces pro-social hormones like oxytocin in the brain, were associated with better mental health outcomes among survivors from the festival. It's thought to be the first time scientists have been able to study a mass trauma event where large numbers of people were under the influence of mind-altering drugs. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has this report from Jerusalem.
Moments before Hamas gunmen attacked, thousands of people were dancing at the Nova Festival near the Gaza border. The stories of what happened to their lives, their friends, their bodies have largely come to light. Now scientists are looking at what was happening to their brains. Many of those dancing at sunrise were high on illegal drugs like MDMA and LSD. One of them was Mihal Ohana.
On October 7, I take MDMA. And today, I know this has helped me.
Mihal now believes the drug helped save her life, preventing her from freezing in fear.
I feel like this has saved my life because I was in so high and I feel like not in this real world. If I didn't take, I stop and I sit on the floor and take me or kill me.
Despite feeling detached from reality at the time, Mihal is still struggling to return to normal life.
I wake up with this and I go sleep with this. And people don't understand. We live this day, every day.
Researchers say there's no hard evidence that drugs helped people like Mihal escape the attacks. But Roy Salomon, leading the research on more than 600 Nova survivors, says initial results suggest MDMA in particular could have helped protect them against the effects of trauma.
People that were on MDMA during the attack, they were sleeping better, they were experiencing less mental distress than other people. MDMA was, one substance that had a protective effect. That means they were actually doing better than people who did not take any substance. Even during the event itself, they were somewhat protected by the fact that there was a reduction of negative affect. So even within this terrible situation, they were able to see the love of their friends, the camaraderie they had within escaping with other people. And then when they got home, they were open to receive the love and care of their families and friends. And this is key.
So right now you're in the therapy room for MDMA, mood lighting, candles, even a bed that we can open up for the treatment. But when you zoom out and you look around us, you'll notice signs that we're actually also in a bomb shelter. We have an air filtration system. You'll notice the thick door, the windows that have the metal shutters. We're set up.
MDMA is already being explored as an experimental treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. And this study is fueling growing interest from scientists in its potential use. Anna Harwood-Gross, Director of Research at Israel's Metiv Psychotrauma Center, says the early results from the NOVA research also help to answer concerns about using it in countries with a high risk of attacks or sirens occurring during treatment.
They've talked about using MDMA in Ukraine. They've talked about using psychedelics in Rwanda. They're questioning, you know, can we use psychedelics in an environment which is not safe? MDMA opens up a lot of potential, but it also makes you vulnerable. You're very vulnerable to everything that's going on around you. And I think that we've learned that if we create the right framework, despite the fact that we're still a country at war, we're able to do this psychedelic treatment.
The Nova Festival site today is home to many memories of pain and heroism, hundreds of memorials for the dead, and perhaps lessons for the world in surviving trauma from those still struggling to live.
And that was our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson for us in Jerusalem. Next, in what looks like turmoil for Reform UK, the party has suspended its MP Rupert Lowe and referred him to the police. It's after allegations that he made threats of physical violence against the party chairman, Zia Yusuf. In a statement with Chief Whip Lee Anderson, Mr. Yusuf also said the party had received reports of bullying in Mr. Lowe's parliamentary and constituency offices. More now on this with our political correspondent, Leila Nathu. Thanks for being with us, Leila. Tell us more about these allegations and how Mr. Lowe has responded.
Well, pretty extraordinary for this to come completely out of the blue earlier this evening. Reform, as you say, released that statement from its chair, Zia Yusuf, and its chief whip, Lee Anderson, talking about having reported its own MP, one of only five Reform MPs, remember, in the Commons. Now they are down one because Rupert Lowe has been suspended from the parliamentary party. So he's been reported to police over these threats of physical violence made to the party chair, Zia Yusuf. Now, the Met says that they have received an allegation, they received one yesterday, about verbal threats made by a 67-year-old man in December, and they were looking into it. But they also describe claims of serious workplace bullying, as they put it, in the offices of Rupert Lowe. Now, he has responded at length online to this, saying these allegations were entirely untrue and that there was no credible evidence against him. But the context for this sort of blow up, if you like, is that earlier this week he had very publicly criticised Nigel Farage's leadership of Reform. He had talked about Reform as a protest party led by what he called a messiah with no proper plan for government. Nigel Farage had responded, so there was a bit of back and forth saying that he had been completely wrong. So tonight, Rupert Lowe is linking what has happened tonight with what has come before. He is saying that this whole episode, the suspension, the making public of an investigation as a malicious reaction to what he calls offering constructive criticism to his party. So, you know, tensions have clearly been building within Reform. And remember, the party's riding very high in the polls. It's looking to professionalise, get its act together to make electoral gains. And meanwhile, you have this big rift at the very top being exposed very publicly tonight.
Well, let's expand on that, because as you rightly highlight, the party has removed the whip from Mr. Lowe, but he is only one of five of its MPs, as you said earlier. I mean, what does this mean more widely for the state of Reform UK?
Well, I mean, I think there are divisions in terms of the direction for Reform. Obviously, Reform is very strongly associated with Nigel Farage as its leader. I mean, he is the person who has the most recognition amongst, you know, any politician, let alone the Reform MPs. So, you know, Rupert Lowe himself is not a household name. There had been some interesting kind of discussions about Rupert Lowe in the context of Elon Musk's involvement with Reform. Remember, there had been discussions about Elon Musk donating to Reform. He then seemed to have turned on Nigel Farage, saying actually that Rupert Lowe potentially had what it took to lead reform. So there had been some divisions there. But I think, you know, what you have is increasingly public recriminations and sort of acrimony between, you know, just the handful of MPs, the most senior members of reform, really, and the most public facing ones, obviously, now kind of exploding into the public domain. And Rupert Lowe's clearly very angry in response. He's talking about, you know, seeking legal advice over all of this, denying everything. So we will see where this goes next. But it's very clear that the leadership of reform wants to take action against him for these allegations, which he denies. But it's certainly not a happy ship at the top of reform.
Leila Natu for us. Thanks for joining us. To Syria now. The country is facing the worst violence since rebels overthrew the Assad regime in December and installed an Islamist transitional government. Security forces of Syria's new Sunni rulers have engaged in heavy combat with fighters loyal to the ousted President Bashar al-Assad in a coastal area in the west. Now, this is a region that is really the heartland of the Alawite minority and a stronghold of the Assad family, which belong to the Alawite sect. And the community says it is being subjected to violence and attacks since Assad fell, particularly in rural Homs and Latakia. Today, the country's interim president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, said his forces will pursue remnants of the Assad regime and bring them to trial. Mohammed lives in a village near Jable, a city a short distance to the south of Latakia. He is an Alawite, and at his request, we are not using his family name. He began by telling us what he saw when the fighters arrived.
I'm currently in an area just outside the city of Jable, in its countryside. Today, I saw a convoy of motorbikes driven by members from the Sunni community in Jable. I managed to identify them because Jable is such a small city that everyone knows each other's faces. These motorbikes were accompanied by a convoy of mostly four-wheel drive vehicles with number plates from Aleppo and Idlib. The people on the motorbikes were helping the people in the cars identify the Alawite houses in the area. You see, Jable is a diverse city with both Sunni and Alawite communities. I felt very scared. I feel that I don't know what I'm going to do. I've never carried arms in my life. I'm not afraid of death. I'm just afraid that my mum or my dad will be killed.
Well, let's speak to our correspondent now in Damascus, Lina Sinjab. Lina, Syria is a country that you follow closely. You have just arrived in the capital. What is the feeling there, considering the news of this latest violence?
Well, probably this is the first time, you know, in years that I feel there is, you know, almost everyone in Syria is engaged in talks, in discussions on social media, on chats. Everyone is really concerned about what's happening at the moment. From one side, people are concerned of violations and killing of civilians. They feel that the new authorities are doing similar practices to the ones they've revolted against that were practiced by Assad's regime, but also they're concerned because remnants of the Assad regime are really out and about trying to cause instability and calling for, you know, separation in the government, calling for international support. And this is something really raising a lot of concerns among many people in Syria. There are voices who are calling for sectarian division, while there are lots of voices coming out and calling for calm, calling for unity. But also calling for accountability for whoever committed, you know, killing and violations.
Lina, can I get your expertise on what you understand about the number of people killed in this latest violence? Because the BBC and our various teams, we've been unable to independently verify the various numbers that we are getting.
Well, this is one of the issues that is really at stake here, because the new authorities, they still don't have like a a media strategy. There is no real platform where you can have official statements, official figures. So all what you rely on is activist accounts and human rights organizations' records on what's happening on the ground. And this is what we've heard from the Syrian Network for Human Rights and the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in the UK, basically quoting the numbers, the figures of people killed, over 200 in the past 2 days. You know, half of them are civilians, and you know, there are over 100 killed from, you know, the security forces and also remnants of the Assad regime. So the numbers are really high, but there are footage and videos that I've seen of you know, dozens of bodies laying on the ground, of you know, many you know, bodies that looked like civilian bodies.
Mm. Lina, we know that there are curfews in place in some of those areas where the fighting has broken out. But looking at the wider picture, this region has become a major security challenge for the current interim president, hasn't it?
It is indeed. This is the first threat to the power, to the new authorities. The interim president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, came out and made a speech addressing the nation, praising the forces of the security, but also vowing to stop and hold accountable all the remnants of the Assad regime. But also he also addressed that there are people who committed violations, that they would be brought to justice. And this is something reassuring for people. But at the same time, it's a big challenge for the authority, especially at a time where in the north also, excuse me, the Kurdish forces refuse to join forces. There are calls for separation. But there are many voices also coming out and saying this is the time to unify efforts in Syria.
Lina Sinjab for us in Damascus. Thank you for being with us. There is a conversation that takes place in many households with young children across the country, most mornings and most evenings. It is possibly less of a conversation and more of a series of questions. Did you brush your teeth? How long did you brush them for? Did you brush them properly? And it can often end with, go and brush them again. Now, data shows that decayed teeth are now the most common reason for children aged 5 to 9 being admitted to hospital. 1 in 4 children aged 5 have experienced tooth decay in England, with higher rates of up to 1 in 3 in more deprived areas. And that is why the government is launching a national toothbrushing program, where school and nursery staff in the most deprived areas of England will be asked to supervise young children whilst they are brushing their teeth. There is lots to talk through with Charlotte Mott, head teacher of Grangetown Primary School on the outskirts of Middlesbrough. They've been running their own toothbrushing scheme for several years. And joining her is Dr. Ursula Devalia, president-elect of the British Society of Paediatric Dentistry. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much. Good evening.
Charlotte, I'd like to start with you, because you've already got a teeth brushing scheme in action at your school. How and when did it start?
So this started a number of years ago. Middlesbrough is one of the areas which has a high level of tooth decay for under 5-year-olds in the northeast. We also felt that as a school, we identified a need within our community. We'd had a number of children who had had their teeth extracted, and some of our younger children too. And we realised that this was something that we needed to look at as a school and work with our families and support our families with. It started off with our younger children, and then over the years we've extended it to throughout the school and to our learning support base.
Practically speaking, how does it play out?
So basically, we follow some robust government guidance when supervising the toothbrushing program in school. The children have their own toothbrushes, and they put toothpaste on, and then we usually try and find songs to encourage and support them.
Dr. Devalia, let me bring you into the conversation here. I imagine you welcome news of this scheme, but give us a sense of how bad the state of children's dental health is in the country right now.
Thank you, Akubo. Well, as you mentioned, this is the leading cause for general anaesthetics in the country for children under the age of 19. And it's been that way for many, many years. So poor oral health really is a major public health issue for us. It's not just about the anaesthetics, it's about the impact on families, it's the social impact, the psychological impact. And not just that, but the pain and suffering that our children are having to go through with this poor oral health affecting school attendance, nutrition, and of course, general health as well. So it really is welcome from the British Society of Paediatric Dentistry and long awaited to catch up with our devolved nations where these sorts of schemes have existed for a number of years already.
And talk us through some of the cases that you tend to treat.
So as a practicing clinician, it's anybody within my same position as a consultant specialist or working in any service delivering general anaesthetics for children. Unfortunately, our bread and butter is daily extractions of multiple teeth. So often we have 2-year-olds, unfortunately, who have something we call a full clearance, which is all 20 teeth being removed almost as soon as they've erupted into the mouths. And, you know, more recently, we're seeing quite a huge spike in young children about the age of 9 or 10. Who are coming in for their front teeth to be removed. Now, the impact of that is not just the financial burden for the NHS, but the psychological and social impact for these children throughout the rest of their life course. So prevention really has to be at the core of anything. And we are really happy to see this initiative and the pledge by the government being released today.
Charlotte, we know that there is enough pressure on state schools at the moment from all directions. And I mean, is toothbrushing really the responsibility of schools rather than parents or guardians, in your opinion?
I agree. I feel that the ultimately it is the parental responsibility. But we like to work in collaboration with our parents. And like Ursula said, this is a national issue. And our worry is for our children is we want them to have the best start in life and we want to be able to help and prevent ill health in their future. Ursula was saying about, you know, we've had some of our children that have had all of their teeth removed in our nursery and reception classes. And our worry is if we don't break this cycle, then we're going to have adults who have poor dental hygiene too. And when you're applying for jobs or you know, the social impact it has on the community, I feel it is really essential.
I do want to squeeze in a question about funding to you, Charlotte, and to you, Dr. Devalia, because the government says that it is going to invest a total of £11 million to local authorities across England to get this scheme off the ground. That is a lot of money for teeth brushing. I know you've been funding this so far from your own school's budget. How much of a difference is this going to make?
So I am very pleased to hear that the government are funding this because, you know, we have seen a decrease in our budgets within schools, and some of the most important things we do in schools are sort of taking a sideline because we're just having to do the essential things with us not having the funding. So I do really welcome that it's a funded scheme and that will help immensely.
Dr. Devalia, how much money might this save?
So we know the cost to the NHS at present is approximately £50 million a year for dental extractions and for treatment for the children we're talking about. And so £11 million in contrast to that might not seem as much. And what we're looking at is an initiative and a public health strategy that we know shows an evidence-based return on investment. So if we take a partner nation in Scotland who have had the Child Smile Initiative since 2006, what they've shown is for a return on investment over 5 years for every £1 that's spent on their programme, we're looking at a £3 return on investment. So actually, in the long term, this will benefit us and release funds, hopefully, into potentially other areas that we need in the NHS. So prevention at the heart of this scheme is exactly what we're looking for long-term gains.
Well, thank you for your expertise, Dr. Ursula Devalia and Charlotte Mott, head teacher of Grangetown Primary School. It's been yet another tumultuous week of the Trump presidency, from his rollout and indeed roll back on tariffs against Canada and Mexico to the suspension of aid and intelligence sharing with Ukraine. In his address to Congress this week, the message from Mr. Trump was very clear. He is just getting started. And today there have been more confusing signals from the president. On one hand, he said he was strongly considering large-scale sanctions and tariffs on Russia until a peace deal was reached. On the other, he said he's finding it more difficult to deal with Ukraine than Russia. I've been trying to get a sense of what Mr. Trump's vision for America might be in a possible new world order. This is the view of Katie McFarland, who was deputy national security advisor in Donald Trump's first administration.
I think it's an understanding that the United States has been taken advantage of. And, you know, willingly, the United States and previous presidencies have allowed it to happen. But that our economic and security contributions to our allies have really been exploited. For example, in NATO, you know, the United States pays for 75% of NATO. And yet the countries of Europe are prosperous. They can afford to pay more towards our mutual defense. So when people say, oh, Donald Trump doesn't like NATO, he's going to pull out of NATO. No, Donald Trump is kind of shaking the member states by their lapels, saying, come on, increase your defense spending. And then we'll have, in fact, a stronger alliance in the end, because otherwise you don't have any skin in the game. We, the United States, are bearing your whole cost. So not only is it better for all of us if we're all participating, but it's frankly better for the United States that we're not underwriting everybody's security and economics. We can't afford to do it. I mean, we've looked at the numbers. Americans have looked at the numbers of our deficit spending. We can't continue to go on like this.
You mentioned NATO there. Is President Trump, in your opinion, committed to defending NATO allies? And would he defend them against Russia?
Well, I think the first question you have to ask is, are NATO allies committed to being part of NATO? Or do they want a free ride? President Trump makes a point of saying, why should the United States pay for Germany's defense when, in fact, Germany is enriching Russia by buying Russia's natural gas? So there's a lot of reconfiguration, I think, of the United States' position in the world. But I don't think that means it's American retreat. If anything, it's America emboldened. You know, America first means America first, but it doesn't mean America's gone.
I've also been speaking to the leading foreign affairs thinker, Fareed Zakaria, a columnist for The Washington Post and a CNN host. This is his take on the events of the week, starting with his response to the potential for increased sanctions by the US against Russia.
What he's threatening, frankly, makes no sense. The United States does not import almost anything from Russia. Russia is under 16 rounds of sanctions. So the idea that you could tariff the small handful of Russian goods coming into the U.S. is a joke. The only pressure Putin would understand is pressure on the battlefield. If he really wants to put pressure on Russia, he should end the pause on the arms to Ukraine, double up on giving Ukraine more assistance, more logistics, more intelligence. That will put pressure on Putin. So for as far as I can tell, this is a very asymmetrical pressure. It is very real and hard pressure on the Ukrainian side and fluff on the Russian side.
What we've seen with regards to the United States and language and behavior towards Russia and Ukraine, many say this is a suggestion of a switching of sides. Is this yet another example of what seems to be quite a mercurial Trump leadership?
I wouldn't call this one mercurial in the sense that there is a pattern here and it's been quite consistent. Donald Trump doesn't like Ukraine and he has some strange affection and admiration for Putin and Putin's Russia. Remember, Ukraine is the country and Zelensky is the leader that Trump tried to blackmail in the first Trump administration. If you recall that famous phone call, Donald Trump was trying to blackmail Volodymyr Zelensky on two issues, and Zelensky didn't give in on either of those issues. He then tried to strong-arm him into accepting an almost neo-colonial minerals deal, which again, Zelensky refused to sign the first version of that deal. And it has largely enraged Trump. On the other hand, you remember in the first Trump administration, he said he trusted Putin more than he trusted his own intelligence agencies. So I view it as a very consistent Trump policy, bewildering, but consistent.
This is, of course, not just about Russia and Ukraine. Europe is watching closely. And in recent days and weeks, many have been taken aback by what some call an assault on NATO, Europe having its own conversations and now making plans about increasing defence spending, boots on the ground. Where does NATO fit into Trumpism, let's call it?
Very poorly, because what Trump has done over the last few weeks is cast into doubt the central core of NATO. The core of NATO is the issue: will an American president go to war if a small European country that is a member of NATO is invaded by Russia? And I think everything Trump has done has cast substantial doubt on that issue. That is a revolution in where we are in international affairs. And it suggests that NATO is in serious trouble.
Linked to what you've just said, though, what about this idea that this is a temporary shift on the part of Mr. Trump to get other countries to step up, to buckle up and decrease dependence on the United States?
Well, I think he will get what he wants. I don't think it will work out to America's benefit, but there's no question that a lot of America's allies are realizing that they are too dependent on the United States, because what Trump has done is to use that dependence to blackmail these countries, from Canada to Denmark to France to Germany. Countries all over that are allied with the United States are going to say to themselves, we need some other options. And what does that mean? Well, for Canada, it probably means a stronger relationship with Europe economically, maybe even in political terms, perhaps an outreach to China. For countries in Europe, it will probably mean, again, warmer relations with China. So everyone is going to try to diversify so that they are not as critically dependent on the United States. I don't regard that as a good thing. It will have the effect of Europe finally spending the kinds of money they need to on their own defense. And that piece of it is a good thing. But the U.S.-Europe alliance, economic, political, technological, military, has been the anchor of stability in the world. And the fact that this anchor is now being shattered is bad for the world. It's bad for stability. And I don't think it's good for the cause of Western democracies to be divided this way.
These bold moves by President Trump, to what extent do you believe these strategies will outlive President Trump's leadership?
Well, that gets to a kind of central question that I don't know the answer to, which is Donald Trump 2.0 the beginning of 20 years or more of populist politics that will dominate the Western world and maybe beyond? Or is this the last gasp of a certain kind of right-wing populism rooted in a white working class that is fading? In other words, in 4 years, if you have a repudiation, not just of Trump, but of Trumpism at the polls, yes, much of this can be repaired. But that is something I cannot confidently tell you that that's what's going to happen in 2028 in America.
The thoughts there of Fareed Zakaria, a columnist for The Washington Post and a CNN host, reacting to what has been yet another eventful week of President Trump, the latest today that he is strongly considering large-scale sanctions and tariffs on Russia. A change in tone. Since coming to office, he has praised President Vladimir Putin and blamed Ukraine's leader for not wanting peace with Russia. And we've also heard him saying just a few hours ago that he was finding it more difficult to deal with Ukraine, and repeated that he trusted Putin. We shall see what the next few days bring. But that is it from this edition of The World Tonight. I'm Krupa Bhatti, and from me and everyone here on the programme, thank you for your company and have a great weekend.